Beirut has experienced its worst night of bombings since Israel intensified its attacks on Hezbollah in Lebanon. Several large strikes were carried out in the southern suburbs of the city overnight. There was a large fireball over the skyline of Lebanon's capital. Earlier, the Israeli military warned people in the affected area to evacuate. Lebanese officials say 23 people died in the strikes across the country yesterday. More than 90 were injured. RTE's Fran McNulty joins us now from Beirut. Fran, tell us what happened there last night. From the images we've seen, it looked like there were some massive explosions.
Yes, almost definitely the most intense to date, Justin. We were just coming off the air on the 9 o'clock news last night, and a few bombs had landed as we were on air. But about half an hour later, in came a very large explosion. And for 4 hours after that, there was sustained fire all over the south of Beirut. We also heard some air missiles landing a little further north up in the hills. The other Christian part of the city is largely unaffected. It's like being in a different place when you travel down there. But where we are over in the south, it has been extremely heavy. One critical thing, a road to the airport was bombed, and that's leading people to get concerned if that sort of approach is being made. And then you're looking at kind of fuel depots, some medical supply stores were hit as well. And if that pattern of intensification is to be followed, people here in Beirut expect it to be worse tonight.
Mm. What's it like there in the city right now, Fran? I mean, what is the sense among the people who are living in Beirut and even where you are at the moment? I mean, are you concerned yourself?
At this moment in time, Justin, we're in a pretty safe location. We just happen to have a very good vantage point on what is happening. But there's a volatility about this. You do not know when or where something could strike. And that is naturally a concern. But what you do in a conflict zone like this is you just, you mind yourself as best you can. You take every precaution and you take no risks. We have a choice. We have chosen to be here and we can choose to leave. But for hundreds of thousands of people, they do not have that choice, Justin. And you see them all over the city. I was drove about 30 minutes from where we're staying this morning. And on the entire drive along the seafront for, I would say, 4 or 5 kilometres, it was lined with displaced people, sleeping in their cars, setting up makeshift tents. They don't even have tents. They're using blankets as tents to sleep under, trying to eat food, naturally huge sanitation issues. They're in parks, they're on squares, they're gathering around mosques. They are all over the city with very little support, very little services, because whatever the state can offer is massively over capacity, and NGOs are struggling as well. They're trying to get some supplies in, but it's very tight.
Israel says that before it drops these bombs, that it does issue evacuation warnings to people. Presumably those warnings are issued by text message on their phones. But I know in some cases the power has been out in Beirut, and perhaps a lot of people won't have their phones charged.
Justin, if you live in Beirut, even if you live in a plush house or a nice apartment, you don't have electricity 24 hours of the day. You only have limited electricity supply. But people use generators mainly. People are using solar panels a lot. But they are coming by text message. There have been no leaflet drops. But the precision of those text messages is quite astounding. They will send you a satellite aerial image, because I see them. I'm in several Telegram groups where they're circulated. We do that for our own safety. They will actually identify a building, put a red box around it, and say, this is where we're going to strike. So, and they can strike with precision. However, last night, we knew that there was going to be 5 locations struck in the neighbourhood adjacent to us. So we were here to watch that happen. However, I lost count, 15, 20, maybe 25 missile strikes in that area for 5 target locations. So the whilst guidance is given and many of those buildings were empty, it's a very densely populated area, so it's very difficult to stay safe when you're in there.
All right, Fran McNulty in Beirut, stay safe and thank you for joining us today. Let's go to Tel Aviv now and speak with our Deputy Foreign Editor, Edmund Heafy, who's there for us. Edmund, we're on the eve of the first anniversary of the October 7th attacks by Hamas on Israel, which were the catalyst for Israel's invasion of Gaza. We'll talk in a moment about how Israel is going to mark that anniversary. But in Gaza, the bombings continue. There was an attack on a mosque and former school there. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, Justin. So those overnight Israeli airstrikes, the death toll from them has now climbed to 26, according to authorities in Gaza, Hamas-run authorities. And at least 93 other people were wounded. So I think it's likely that the death toll will climb from that in the next few hours. Now, the Israeli military is using its usual terminology. It described the strikes as precise and said they were targeting Hamas terrorists who were operating command and control centers in these buildings. Now, Hamas has over and over rejected the suggestion that it uses civilian buildings for those kind of purposes. And it's simply hard to tell who is telling the truth without independent verification. But the death toll and the number of people injured, I suppose, would suggest the strikes were anything but precise. And though the conflict in Lebanon with Hezbollah has diverted attention away from Gaza, it's been a particularly deadly week in the enclave. Nearly 100 people were killed in one 24-hour period early in the week.
Tomorrow, Edmund, is the anniversary of the October 7th attacks in which Hamas killed around 1,200 people and took 251 hostages, 97 of whom are still being held hostage today. It triggered a response from Israel, which has seen more than 41,000 Palestinians killed and over 1,700 Israelis are also dead. How is Israel going to mark the anniversary of the Hamas attacks tomorrow?
Well, Justin, I have to say it's been a fairly muted build up to the anniversary. I think a lot of Israelis and many of the people I've been speaking to feel like Israel is still in the eye of the storm, still experiencing the trauma. And of course, there's that new front in the war in northern Israel and a wider regional escalation. In terms of commemorations, there's been an awful lot of controversy about the official government ceremony. It's a pre-recorded ceremony, highly choreographed. It's due to be broadcast tomorrow. But many of the towns and kibbutzim in the south of Israel that were deeply affected refused to take part. And it's just two small cities that have traditionally been supportive of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party are participating in that. And then there was also due to be 40,000 people gather tomorrow evening at an alternative memorial. But due to the situation in the north and also fears that Iran could target such a large gathering, they've asked people now not to attend that.
And you mentioned Iran there. Israel is also planning to respond to last week's missile attack by Iran. When might that response come and what might Israel be planning?
Well, Justin, there was a sense last night here that there was something quite imminent, but the night came and went without anything happening. I think it's safe to say they're surely in the final stages of planning the attack and choosing targets. The Israeli cabinet has given Mr. Netanyahu and his defence minister the power to decide on the timing and what to do there. So the full cabinet won't have to meet before the green light is given. And it looks like they'll probably avoid targeting Iranian oil installations after US President Joe Biden said that he would be considering alternatives. But now there's also the suspicion that the government could strike Iran tomorrow on the anniversary, in part to distract from the ire about government failings.
All right. Well, we shall see. Edmund Heafy, RTE's Deputy Foreign Editor, thank you for joining us from Tel Aviv. In southern Lebanon, Israeli soldiers crossed the blue line, the effective border between Israel and Lebanon, and took up positions close to an outpost manned by 30 Irish troops serving as UN peacekeepers. Israel has been engaged in battles with Hezbollah fighters near the town of Marun al-Ras. Taoiseach and Defence Minister Micheál Martin described the Israeli incursion into Lebanon as an unacceptable violation of a UN Security Council resolution. President Michael D. Higgins accused Israel of threatening peacekeepers and seeking to have them evacuate the villages that they are defending. Israel rejected the president's criticisms as unfounded and inflammatory. The outpost where the Irish soldiers are stationed is called UNP 652. It's just metres from the border with Israel. Security analyst Declan Power is on the line. Declan, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Tell us about the Irish outpost UNP 652, where it is and why it is such an important location.
It is one of two positions that the Irish are responsible, or the Irish Polish Battalion are responsible for, and it is it's located, as you've just said, right on the border with Israel. This is not an unusual situation for Irish troops to have found themselves in over the last 30 odd years, and it is of particular importance because the troops in that position are in a very they're very well situated to see what is happening on the ground and to give accurate reports back to UNIFIL headquarters, which those reports go back to New York, and to establish within the international community the facts of what are happening with regards to the engagement of both combatants. To move them out of that position would, from one perspective, it would be to give Israel a much freer hand in its manoeuvring. And it would allow them an uncontested space, not militarily speaking, but from a reporting perspective. So it is important that they hold their position. But we also should bear in mind there's a heightened level of danger because of Israelis in and around those positions. There's two schools of thought on this. One is that it attracts Hezbollah attentions in that area, and Hezbollah have shown themselves to be singularly uncaring about UN lives as well, as the death of Private Sean Rooney proved. But the Israelis' intent is to by weight of firepower as well as numbers, to push Hezbollah back further and further from being able to launch munitions into that area and around the border. So in one sense, it means that there's probably less likely to be a Hezbollah response to that area, attack, you know, or to launch it, munitions in that area. However, the other side to it is those Irish troops are now existing on emergency rations, and they will eventually need to be resupplied. And how that gets done will be another test of the ingenuity of UNIFIL troops, and particularly Irish soldiers in those positions. But we should remember this has happened before, and it's not too different to what happened in 1980 at a place called Atiri, where Irish troops came under fire, and it developed into a battle for about 4 or 5 days that led to the highest amount of gallantry awards in the history of the Irish Defence Force, where 4 soldiers were decorated.
There are 30 soldiers at that outpost, UNP 652. What actions will they be taking at the moment to protect themselves? I know I've been there, and I know they have a bunker there that is fairly well protected. So will they be in that bunker today?
Yes, a number of them, a significant number of them. They're at what's known as level 3 in terms of force protection measures. Now, it's worth noting that in the space of the over 30 years engagement in peacekeeping operations in Lebanon, the force protection measures of the UNIFIL force, and the Irish in particular, have improved immeasurably. The quality of the personal protection gear that troops wear is much better than it would have been when I was serving in the army, and the quality of armoured vehicles that are in use are much better than would have been in use. The bunkers have been are reinforced with concrete as well as gabions. Gabions are literally cages of rocks that are found locally, and they have been much more much improved with ventilation and with resources for people to live there for a sustained period. But it's important to realise that the troops don't all go to ground. As much as can be spared go to ground, so to speak. There are troops manning observation posts. There are troops manning operations rooms. Some of those operations areas will be within the bunkers. But the troops will not be just, you know, absent from their role as observers.
All right. Declan, thank you very much for speaking with us today. That's Declan Power, security analyst.